Honest Thieves, Dishonest Thieves, and Captain America. Today, I want to talk about organized crime and then about culture wars. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow's shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency, and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons, who also receive extra perks and bonuses appropriate to their tier. If you'd like to join them, just head on to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. But now, on with today's programme. So, today I want to talk about gangsters. Not the politicians, spooks, and cronies that I'm usually discussing, who, let's be honest, could be considered gangsters in their own way. No, I mean proper gangsters. Or as proper as they can be these days. And in particular, I want to explore and interrogate three terms or concepts which are extant in the Russian underworld, or at least in outside conceptions of the Russian underworld. And from them, get a sense of where it is now, basically, and where it might be going. The first of those concepts is the honest thief, the честный вор, which I suppose also translates as the honourable thief. And it's really quite an interesting insight, I think, into sort of wider issues of Russian culture. And it carries with it this notion that everyone is essentially a thief. The only real distinction is between the honest thieves and the dishonest thieves. The dishonest thieves are the ones who wear suits or uniforms or judges' robes and are meant to be on the side of the people and yet still rob them blind. While the honest thieves are, of course, those who are also robbing you blind if they can, but at least they're straightforward about it. And it says something because, after all, we must remember that there is no real cultural equivalent of the Robin Hood myth in Russian folklore. The closest there is Vanka Kain, 18th century brigand, fraudster and so forth, who in due course was arrested, was turned by the SISK, the investigative police of the time, and became an informant, and who actually corrupted his own handlers so that he could carry on with his crimes. The problem being, though, is that his corrupt handlers began to become more and more demanding, and so he was having to carry out more and more dangerous and audacious operations until, once again, he was caught. Now, the thing about Vanka Kain is there is no question but that he was a bad un. He was a bad guy, he was a crook, a gangster, a thief, all these various things. However, the real moral opprobrium of the story is precisely on the corrupt investigators who, having arrested him and turned him into an informant, then became seduced by the corrupt opportunities and actually pushed Kain himself more and more into criminality. They were undoubtedly not honest thieves. The Vanka Kain story is an important one. In some ways, it's really the start of what we might think of as popular literature in Russia. But it also says something about the moral economy, which is present. Everyone's a thief, just whether you're honest or dishonest. However, the interesting thing is that these days, this notion that organised crime is still largely made up of honest thieves is in itself deeply problematic for all kinds of reasons, not least because it actually misunderstands what's been going on within the underworld. But the point is, the reason why people are still clinging, in some cases, not so much, I mean, it's not quite as romanticised as once it was, but the reason why people still cling to this notion is, I would suspect and suggest, really about the absolute lack of faith in the upper world, in the structures of what we think of as legitimate society. The annual Edelman Trust Barometer survey, for example, shows Russia has one of the lowest levels of trust towards, well, pretty much anyone outside their own family and their own personal circle. Obviously not the state, but also NGOs, business, media, even outside institutions like the European Union and the United Nations. In 2019, Only 34% said they trusted the government, and only 26% said they trusted the media. So these are very, very low figures in terms of international comparison. And even so, I mean, these are actually down on 2018 figures. And in January, we'll get to see what the 2020 results were. But my suspicion is, particularly with COVID, is actually these will have fallen yet further. But why the crooks? Why, therefore, is there still this image of the crooks somehow being, in their own unpleasant, rapacious, predatory, thuggish ways, at least honest? Well, to an extent, it's because of another now problematic notion. The Vorovskoy Mir, the criminal world, and with it, the notion of the Vori v Zakonye, which literally means thieves within the law, but is really better translated as thieves within the code, because the law that they were within is very much their own law. There is this notion of a distinct criminal subculture with its own code and, in the form of the Vori v Zakonye, arbiters, role models and virtual high priests of the whole criminal way. It's understandable because it evolved in its own way as a result of economic and above all political changes that were taking place. So forgive me, I'm going to give you a very, very brief historical whistle-stop tour. If you want more, I have to give the obligatory little plug here. You can find it in my book, The Vori, available in a variety of languages, including Russian, I would add. Anyway, the real roots were in the late 19th century urbanisation and industrialisation of Russia, and particularly the Yami, the pits, the god-awful urban slums that emerged. I mean, no country's industrial revolution tends to be a cheery, clean and pleasant experience for the majority. Russia's, as you'd expect, it was very much a state-driven crash modernisation, was particularly rough. And these Yami basically were no-go zones to the state. And within them began to emerge a kind of parallel or separate order, the Vorovskoy Mir. And that's really when it emerged. With the 20th century and above all with Stalin and the Gulag system, that totally transformed, metastasized the Vorovskoy Mir. The Gulags obviously concentrated the criminals, so criminals from all around the country were thrown together. And their alliances were forged, and the common language, fenya, of the underworld became much, much more widely experienced. And in particular, we tend to think of the Gulags as being a fairly static experience. You're sent to your labour camp, and there you labour until you die, or whatever. Well, actually, the experience of the Gulags was a very mobile one, as workers were shifted from camp to camp, from region to region, as a new mine opened or an old one became tapped out or whatever else. The so-called etap system of constant sort of shifting of convoys of prisoners actually ensured that the mindset, the values, the language and so forth could be genuinely propagated around the entire country. And this is really when we actually have the Vori v Zakonye emerging as this kind of social class of authority figures. They didn't necessarily run gangs, but they were regarded as being the archetypes for what a true thief meant. You had to be vouched for by your peers, you had to have demonstrated that you've never ever cooperated with the authorities and so forth. This would come under pressure, this whole system would come under pressure. The Stalin era saw attempts to co-opt them. The criminal class eventually divided, broadly speaking, into two, the traditionalists, the blatnia, and those who were willing to cooperate to a limited extent with the state, who became known as the suki, the bitches. In the late 40s and early 50s, and I am, as I said, very much sort of zooming through this, there were a series of internal struggles, virtual wars within the Gulag system, and ultimately it was the collaborators, the suki, who won, who in effect edited the code of the Vorovskoy Mir in the 1950s and the 1960s to allow limited and very pragmatic cooperation with the state, or at least elements of the state, particularly corrupt officials. So this is the pattern that basically obtained through most of the post-war Soviet era, that you had an increasingly corrupt Communist Party whose bosses and figures would from time to time have value for themselves in pragmatic transactional alliances with gangsters. But the gangsters were very much behind the scenes. Everything changes, frankly, with Gorbachev. And you have both huge opportunities for them, the anti-alcohol campaign that gives them new markets, the cooperative movement of small-scale local enterprises that provides opportunities for them to get into the business sector as well as launder their money, and generally the collapse of the state. But it also creates a crisis, because what happens is you have the old thuggish Voriva Zarkonia and a new rising elite of what we could think of as criminal entrepreneurs, criminal businessmen, the so-called autoriteti. And in my view, the final end of this struggle really could be marked with on 9th October 2009, when Vyacheslav Ivankov, known as Yaponchik, Little Jap, one of the real last of the true old school Vori, was coming out of a restaurant. He was gunned down as part of his role in a business dispute. And with him, really, I think, the Vori Vazakonia, as they were, have now disappeared. You still have the names and the titles on the surface, people who call themselves Voriva Zarkonia and so forth, but there's no real code backing it up. They're thieves within the code without a real code. And instead, what's happened is that whereas once to be a Vor, you actually had to be a genuine, broad-based legitimacy within the underworld, now basically it's something that you grant your mates. You go for a weekend's drinking in Greece or Dubai or Cyprus. You bestow upon them the title, and if other people choose to recognise it, well, really, that's up to them. And interestingly, this title, which is now a little more than a gangster vanity number plate, is particularly held these days by figures from the Caucasus region. Even Russian gangsters are much, much less bothered about it. And instead, what was actually happening is Russian organised crime, or Russian-based organised crime, because in a way, when I say Russian, they could well not be necessarily ethnic Russians. They could be Dagestanis or Georgians or whatever, is increasingly becoming like everyone else's organised crime, really, driven by greed, by pragmatism, and with gangsters having a whole portfolio of interests, from the essentially legitimate through to the entirely criminal. And so what this means is the most successful criminals, the most successful autoriteti, really begin to interpenetrate the lower and local levels of the state and business elite. So what? Well, I'll come to that in a moment. Just want to look at that one last notion to unpick, which flows from the point I've just made about this interpenetration. And that is to look at this term, the mafia state. Now, look, this has long been one of my bugbears, a term that is journalistically convenient, but I would suggest analytically deeply problematic. It implies, after all, that either the organised crime world controls the Kremlin, or the Kremlin controls the world of organised crime. And neither of these is true. Now, yes, we sometimes see relationships between not just individuals within it, but the state apparatus itself and organised crime. And clearly there is corruption, but there is something that I've dubbed Krimintern, which we see particularly outside Russia, in which gangsters are from time to time co-opted as instruments of the state. And I want to talk about that more in a future podcast. But generally speaking, first of all, any such relationships are pragmatic, and they're transactional. They're not institutionalized relationships. They're not lasting ones. They're just simply, we need something to be done. Who can we pay or induce to do it? And that doesn't matter if we're talking about the state turning to the gangsters or the gangsters turning to elements within the state. Secondly, there is no question at all that the state is vastly more powerful. In the 1990s, one could talk about an era where there was even the danger that we'd actually think of as Russia as a failed or failing state. Now, though, it's not the case. And thirdly, there is real policing going on all the time. This notion of Russia as a gangster paradise really doesn't apply. I mean, there is a steady stream of arrests and, more to the point, convictions of gangsters. Not necessarily the people at the absolute top of the system who tend to have some kind of political protection, but people below that. If one looks, for example, at the website Prime Crime, which is basically a gangster news outlet run by a mix of professionals and fanboys, which I find absolutely fascinating. It says something about the interest in the underworld that you still find within Russians. Anyway, that website is full of cases of people precisely that, being arrested and being sent to prison. Okay, so what? What are the big takeaways from that? Well, first of all, look, organised crime is absolutely very significant in Russia, but it's not dominant. The state does provide some kind of limits to how it operates, and frankly, could push a lot harder, but this is not a priority. And this dates back, frankly, from about the year 2000, when Putin first came to power. He essentially offered the criminals a social contract that said, you stay out of anything that looks like it's a challenge to the state, which includes indiscriminate violence on the streets, and we will not treat you as an enemy of the state. So they could always turn the screws. But the point is, this is not a priority. It would involve resources. It would involve some kind of resistance from the underworld. So if we're looking for parallel, it's frankly more like, say, Italy rather than Mexico. And even maybe that's unfair to Russia. Organized crime is controlled. Secondly, organized crime is definitely separate from the state. Now, there may be some kind of parallels between the way that Putin's inner circle and the politics thereof, how it works, and how organized crime work. But I think this is more of a statement about how personalized politics without institutional controls works than rather than any kind of direct organized crime link. It's convenient and handy, and I've done it myself, to draw parallels between Putin and a mafia godfather. But we have to accept the sense that this is a snappy little parallel, but it is not something that really tells us anything serious and sensible and useful about how the Russian state works, and it certainly doesn't suggest that organized criminality is to be found there. The third point is that Russian organized crime is extraordinarily entrepreneurial and dynamic. It operates across borders. Interesting, we just recently had a case in which some Ukrainian criminals were caught by the Spanish police smuggling weapons, which they had got from the conflict zone. But the point is, this was actually an offshoot of a much wider element of cooperation that we see between Russian and Ukrainian gangsters. Their countries may be at undeclared war, but the gangsters work without any kind of trouble. And one can actually say, let's be honest, considering the huge extent to which they also not just move across national borders, but move across institutional and functional borders within the economy, being perfectly happy to work within the legal sector if that's what makes the money, or in the grey sector, or in the criminal. What a waste of human capital this represents. Fourthly, Russian organised crime is networked. Smaller scale gangs, the sort that, you know, control this particular district of this town or whatever, tend to be the sort of classic pyramidal hierarchy with a boss and lieutenants and sort of foot soldiers on the ground. But if you look at the bigger national networks, they're just that. They are fluid networks, which means that there is no thing there. If you want to deal with organized crime, it's not about identifying 5, 10 or 50 kingpins and taking them out. There is no sort of equivalent of the big, say, Japanese Yakuza or Chinese triads. Instead, what you actually have are entirely pragmatic, fluid networks of gangs and individuals who come together for particular tasks and then move on in other directions. They have certain connectivities. They know they can, to an extent, trust each other. But their point is that there is no chain of command. There is no real hierarchy. Final broad point is, though, this particular structure, this organisation, this order, is increasingly coming under pressure, and it has for some years now. And with it, the understanding of turf delineations and pecking orders and rules of the game, which really are a product of the late 90s and the 2000s. First real sort of force that has been distorting and pressurising this has been Afghan heroin. Remember, Russia, fortunately, is no longer quite the highest per capita user of heroin in the world, but it's pretty much up there at the top. And also, you have a massive flow of heroin and other opiates into Europe and beyond. So the gangs which are able to, in effect, tax these particular flows, they're the gangs that suddenly get a lot more money. Secondly, sanctions. Sanctions, and particularly the Russian counter-sanctions on certain imported goods, have also created new pressures, but also new opportunities. And we see this particularly in organised crime groups which are based near the Belarus border, which until relatively recently was an absolute backwater, but has now become a key route for moving essentially smuggled imported luxury goods and foodstuffs and such like in via Belarus. And these gangs are also involved in moving money out via Belarus into the European Union to avoid economic sanctions as well. Then, obviously, we've had COVID, and you've had the usual expectations of, obviously, sort of certain gangs getting involved in frauds and so forth connected to that. But also, COVID brings an economic slowdown, which inevitably puts pressure on certain groups. If you are a gang that has a serious and stable long-term source of funds, such as, for example, access to the heroin trade, and particularly also if you're a gang which operates not just using the ruble, but also other currencies, so you can effectively arbitrage your risks between them, then you're doing well. If you're not, if you're a kind of a small-scale, low-level gang that, you know, relies more on, you know, shaking down local traders and so forth, and is thus very much dependent on the ruble economy, well, you may be in trouble. And we've seen, certainly from previous periods of economic trouble, that what that tends to mean is a consolidation, on the one hand, as the richer gangs basically buy up the smaller ones, but also increasing tension over turf, access to resources and such like. So the question is, of course, you know, how long and how far will this status quo survive? Now, there's lots more I could talk about organised crime, operations abroad, as I mentioned, how far the state uses them, and also the whole world of computer hackers. In which it's worth noting, we think of the Russians as the people who carry them out, and that's certainly true. But increasingly, Russia is also a target. There was a recent case, for example, North Korean hackers attacking Russian targets. Anyway, there's a lot more I could talk about, but given the way the clock's moving, I think that's for another time. But the summation is, frankly, there are no more honest thieves. There is simply a status quo which is in effect requires the thieves not to be quite so brazen in their actions. And if we do see the current status quo break, then we'll probably see a lot more violence and a lot less credibility for this notion of the Chesne Vodya. Secondly, the Vorovskoy Mir is dead. It might not fully know that yet, but essentially the old days of a code, they're long since gone. It's all about money, power, and what you can get away with. But thirdly, this is not a mafia state. This is a state with massive levels of often deeply well-organized corruption at the top. But that's not the same as organized crime, as we think of it. And we need to realize that what this means is that there is still hope. That at least, although I don't imagine we'll see it under Putin, but at least it is possible, if need be, for the Russian state to turn against the gangsters. And again, in a future one of these podcasts, I'll look at what that might mean. But for now, I'd like to thank patron Andras Tothsithra, whose name I've probably, alas, mangled, sorry about that, for suggesting this, and remind you that this is going to be, in effect, the introductory one of a series of podcast segments looking at a whole variety of aspects relating to the good old Russian mafia, and what developments in Russia might mean for the rest of us. But for now, I think it's time for a break. Just the usual reminder, you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. You can support it by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the show. So I wanted to make a very brief closing comment that was prompted by everyone's favourite thuggish warlord, Chechnya's Ramzan Kadyrov. Last week, he was touring a new housing development in the city of Kurchaloy when he came across the Children's Play Centre, which, horror of horrors, had murals featuring such imperialist swine as Thor, Iron Man, Superman, and, worst of all, Captain America. Now, he fulminated that these were fantasies, says the man who's happy to cosplay the roles of war hero, father of the nation, Muslim icon, and, looking at his private zoo, Dr. Doolittle. But anyway, he ordered that all such murals across the entire republic be replaced with historical figures. Chechen historical figures, of course. And what Ramzan wants, Ramzan gets. And they were duly and very rapidly replaced with images of Chechen heroes of the past, including, no partiality here, his dad, Akhmat Kadyrov, the assassinated former strongman of Chechnya, whose name also graces the largest mosque in Chechnya, and even the name of what was Terek Grozny Football Club, which is now Akhmat Grozny. Now, beyond just another isn't Kadyrov funny kind of story, I dwell on this because it does highlight actually how dense the Russian cultural space is with foreign, especially American, memes, icons and imports. You can watch your Hollywood blockbusters, well, I mean, when there still were Hollywood blockbusters. Indeed, I remember actually once I was just walking through a residential part of Moscow and was confronted with this huge mural that sort of covered an entire side wall of a housing block, which was precisely a Captain America film advert, which is quite surreal to find. Beyond that, you can shop at Marks and Spencer's or Hamleys, Sephora or Timberland. You can basically get your full fill of all the various distinctive Western cultural exports. And look, while there are undoubtedly efforts to push the Russian cultural theme and Russian cultural icons, especially around the Great Patriotic War and other aspects of history in the Russian Orthodox Church, and sometimes sanctions on very, very specific and particular imports, you know, this is in no way North Korea. This is no way a country that feels embarked on a full-scale cultural war. Now, why? Well, I mean, one could suggest, first of all, one answer is simply that the state isn't interested in picking that particular fight, given the inevitable political backlash. But I'm not convinced that a regime that tries for a while to ban the ubiquitous Telegram messaging social media app thinks in these terms. Okay, alternatively, how about is this just simply a product of a lack of political bandwidth? Again, I don't think the regime really works that way. A signal from the Kremlin, a simple signal, and you would have mayors and governors, pundits and parliamentarians all jumping over themselves in their zeal to deliver and hopefully earn themselves a pat on the head. You know, this is not the kind of regime that relies on micromanaging from the top often. It precisely relies on this kind of entrepreneurial voluntarism from below. So if that's what they wanted, they could have done so much, much more clearly. Rather, I think it is a sign of not just that this is not a totalitarianism, but also that there is a fundamental desire which goes all the way up to the very top of the political system. And yes, Mr. Putin, I'm thinking of you, which is to return to the West. But its West and on its terms. So this is not about allowing Russia to become tainted by gay rope and political correctness and flabby moral relativism. Nor is it to surrender to the hawkish global hegemons of Washington or the feckless hypocrites of Brussels, which is how I believe they see them, but rather to restore to Europe and the West as a whole the moral certitude, the values, the confidence that it has lost. So they ultimately, I think, feel that we abandoned them, not the other way round. But that one day, the prodigal will be back. And when they think of the prodigal, they mean that we will return to them rather than the other way round. So in the meantime, you can have your Captain Americas and your Supermans and your Marks and Spencers. There's nothing wrong with that, as long as you ultimately appreciate where the arrow of historical destiny lies. I honestly think that that is the kind of calculation that is being that it takes place within the kind of cultural elites and within the people who give them their cues. For the rest of us, of course, it's just that a lot of these films are really quite fun, even if Ramzan doesn't like them. And on that note, it's time to end. Thank you, as ever, for listening. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.